Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with teacher and socialist Andy Livson and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda and a third socialist and teacher AJ Johnstone. It's so great to have you, AJ, back on an episode. I just wanted to tell you that.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy.
Very quickly, let's just do some housekeeping. We are online at what-s-left.webnode.com, and we would appreciate if you would subscribe, rate, review, and turn on your notifications to any of our six platforms. Today, we'll be discussing an article, dissecting it, as we have previously done so, or Kenny and Andy have done so with a video, and the three of us have done two other articles, if I remember correctly. Andy, would you like to introduce what we will be discussing, a recommendation?
Yeah. So this article was sent to me by a fellow educator. He's a paraprofessional up in Seattle. He's also a socialist, used to be in the ISO. And it kind of touches on some issues I've been really thinking about that we haven't had a chance to talk about here recently. It's an article from the New York Times called The Coronavirus Schools Briefing. It's a regular series that they have, but this one talked about some issues in the San Francisco Unified School District, both are issues around reopening, but also discussion around this idea of changing the names of some of the schools. So both these issues are in the article, and these are things that irritate me to hear about and read about. And so I invited AJ to join us in reacting to this article and to get her thoughts on it. So that's the idea. So this is an article written by November 4th, written by Amelia Nierenberg, and it goes, "Good morning. As the results of the 2020 election hang in the balance, more than 56 million school children are still struggling to learn during a pandemic. On Tuesday, more than 92,000 Americans tested positive for COVID-19, and the seven-day average of daily cases rose to a new high of over 88,000. Today, we decided to take a focused look at San Francisco, a district that epitomizes the heated debate over reopening schools."
All right, so I'll start by saying I wish there were a heated debate, but I don't know where this heated debate is happening. I wish it were happening at my school. I wish it were happening amongst the people that I'm working with. And I wish that there was actually a forum for us to have a debate about whether or not this was happening. I'm glad we can talk about it here, but this is not something that is actually being discussed and debated. Debate makes it sound like there's a conversation happening where we're going to decide something. And that seems to have been settled right now.
The thing that comes to mind for me here is this notion of moving goalposts. When COVID first came out, it was about keep flattening the curve. It was about keep making sure our hospitals weren't overloaded. As far as I can tell, and I've looked at this stuff, the curve has mostly been flattened. It was never about just cases of people who had the infection. It was, and I don't believe hospitals are overloaded. And in fact, I will say there was a study came out in October from NPR since there isn't a debate, that had this to say. On October 14th, the Infectious Diseases Society of America gave a briefing on safe school reopenings. Bottom line, this is a quote, "The data so far are not indicating that schools are a super spreader site. Then it goes on to talk about other schools in Thailand, in South Africa, in Vietnam, in Gambia, in Japan, where they're basically opening the schools had seemingly no impact on a correlation between the rise or the fall of the levels of COVID. And that was also true in Spain. I think only in the United Kingdom did they see a trend of upward infections when they had a reopening of schools. So the fact that there's so much information out there already that people have looked at and seen no connection to those things, we're just not hearing that information. And I feel like the goalposts around staying closed have changed.
I'm glad you mentioned Spain, because there right now, I was just speaking to my friend there, and they're going through a very challenging time because they're going through another lockdown, but the schools are being remained opened. And so are they in France. And the schools are staying open. I'll just say I'm going to try to be honest here with this episode because it is challenging having these conversations when you are amongst a lot of people who are teacher friends and are strong union members that don't want schools to reopen right now. And there's a lot of, at least in the circles as that I am in, they want to wait it out. But then there are some friends who won't speak up and say, yeah, that we should reopen, because they don't want to cause tension. It's such a delicate subject. And so I guess that's what I'm going through right now. I want to say what I want to say about it, but I also appreciate that we'll have the space for it.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that this is, something that almost everybody, I can count two people who I work with every day who have a different opinion other than we need to wait for a vaccine and wait at home and wait till, for a very long list of things to happen. It's definitely a minority position. But New York City public schools should be on that list. They are open and have
That's
not,
true.
New York City public schools are open, and the spike in case numbers that they are seeing in New York right now, the New York Times itself is very clear about the fact that that is not because schools are open, and, has actually the editorial page in the New York Times, which is no friend to the working class, is asking for, bars, restaurants, and other places to be, more strictly regulated right now so that schools can continue to stay open, because it has been successful there.
San Francisco divided. Restaurants, movie theaters, and museums are open at reduced capacity. The share of coronavirus tests that come back positive in the city has stayed low since the surge over the summer. But as some San Francisco's private and parochial schools have begun to reopen their doors, its public school district has not set a timeline for resuming in-person instruction, except to say that it's not likely in this calendar year. That has made San Francisco the latest flashpoint over school reopening. This politically progressive city is also California's most unequal area, and its sharp debate about how to best safely educate low-income and minority students during the pandemic resonates across the country.
I'll just state that a block away from me is a private school from my house, and they have reopened. And I checked in with, it's a religious school. And I spoke with the pastor there, and because he lives in the neighborhood, and we've spoken a few times because of my previous involvement with other campaigns. And he's telling me it's going well. The teachers are getting tested. The students are coming regularly, and those that feel that they should not come, they don't come. And so when I see here that the schools, private schools, have begun to reopen, that I've been a witness to that here, and they're doing well. And I'm wondering what they're doing differently from SFUSD, San Francisco Unified School District. What can be learned, or what is holding SFUSD back from these private schools?
Well, the first thing I guess I would say is, like, there's a number of students who've asked me while I'm doing my Zoom classes, when are we going to start again? Like, thinking that it might be happening in November. Like, they asked sometime back in October thinking it was happening in November, or they're asking now in November thinking it might be happening in December or January. And for it to just be a throwaway line, like, the calendar year, it's gone, without really any discussion by teachers. Like, I still believe a majority of teachers would say, we have to keep ourselves safe, keep our students safe, we're not going to go back. But the fact that we don't have that discussion with our teachers, the fact that that discussion isn't happening with families, the fact that they're just asserting it as if it's actual safety, one, that's not backed up by these studies that are being done either in this country or in other countries around, quote, safety of health. It's certainly not backed up by the statistics of, like, if you're between 0 and 25, I think you have like a 0.03% chance of dying if you get infected. I mean, in terms of the fatality rate for people between the ages of 0 and 25 is very small. And it doesn't, it gets higher and higher as people get older. And the fact is what we're doing right now is not at all safe for students. Like every day they're engaging online, getting a much less of an education because we're going much more slowly in a medium that kills. Public education wasn't doing that greatest job about inspiring people to be learners. And now it's even worse. And so people's desire to learn is getting less, I believe. And then the question of socialization and being with each other and learning about each other, that's out the window for an entire year for people who are young. And this is very harmful. It's very destructive, as well as like back to school night. Back to school night for me usually has been 30 or 40 families that I'll see. I had zero families show up. And Eduardo, you can attest to that. And I wasn't the only teacher who had zero families show up at back to school night. It was other teachers report 0, 0, 1, 2. These are parents disengaging from our school. Our school is being eradicated as a place that a community comes to, which is, we're going to talk, I think, even more about that later when we talk about the naming of these schools. But it's what's happening is intensely destructive to the notion of a community in a school and that being something that's being done together. So I just think it's so cavalier and outrageous for them to just throw it away. Oh, calendar year, bye. You know, I think it's really bad.
The conversation has been so, this question about whether or not anything's going to happen even in, say, January has been so, so, so limited. And nothing has changed. They're saying the same thing now that they said back in March when we first shut down, that if there is any sort of return that happens, it's first going to be pre-K to first grade. It's going to be limited students. It's going to be students with severe, moderate or severe learning disabilities. That's who's going to be coming back to schools first. And, you know, that has not changed at all. So in all of these many months, nothing has changed. This article comes out, and there's a few others that happened in the Chronicle, you know, prior to this New York Times article. And then the school board responds with saying that now they're going to start putting pressure on the district and the district has to start making a plan. There was a follow-up article in the Chronicle a couple of days ago, but the school board is now doing nothing at all except for trying to turn down the heat on the fact that there's no plan to actually reopen schools and that it's certainly not going to happen for any but the youngest of students in a very limited fashion. They're now proposing a resolution to pass to tell the school district to do the exact plan that they've already been working on and saying that they were going to do since April. So there's like, you know, press conference and school board members standing behind podiums, but really nothing is changing. And it is really shameful if you go look at their own publicity and their website for families about the progress that's being made towards creating some kind of conditions that they've put in place for safe return. I mean, they're listing things like not having enough signs to tell people where to go in buildings as a reason that they are not ready to reopen, like inadequate signage. I mean, it's very shameful to me. I don't know how these people hold their head up in public. There was an Education Week article that was really interesting to me to see that came out last week from the dean of the public health school at Brown University, who said that schools districts need to be more aggressive about reopening, that they are contributing to an exacerbating public health crisis and mental health crisis for students by being so overly and ridiculously cautious about schools reopening. It's worth looking at. I mean, he talks about this, the fallacy of temperature taking, the ridiculous notion of something like deep cleaning and the obsession with surfaces, bleach wipes. It's really interesting. I mean, he's saying that, like Andy was saying, if you look at the actual numbers of the risk to students, student to student transition, even student to adult transition, there's just nothing that supports this level of refusal to make a real plan. So then I guess that gets us to what's really going on. The private schools are opening.
Just to make it, I guess, a little more complex, in San Francisco, again, it seems like the priorities are different, right? Restaurants, I work in the restaurant industry. And there are pockets in the city where people are just drinking, obviously their inhibitions are lower, they're socializing in mass concentrations of people. And, and the numbers have stayed relatively low. I mean, that's just to say that they have prioritized reopening businesses and not schools. In obviously Europe, like Eduardo mentioned, and other countries are actually in the second wave, they're closing social areas, right? Especially where alcohol is involved, but keeping schools open. So again, this kind of highlights that, there is a deliberate, there's thought, there's not like they don't know what they're doing. It's because, and again, me as a restaurant worker, we know in a lot of studies show that these social areas are actually more prone to spread, the virus than schools. And yet again, we are being forced into situations and exposed to, if this thing is so dangerous. And then again, I mean, there's another element that when I engage in conversations with people, they often throw back the argument that we are the safest city in the world. The numbers are low, we kept the curve low. Yet I think that we ignore the fact that a lot of people that live in socialize in San Francisco don't live in San Francisco. And there is areas around the Bay, like around the city, that actually have higher incidences of. So again, there's like a mix of justifications as to why we're doing what we're doing, what the city's doing. And ultimately what it ultimately does is we don't question city officials. We just follow their lead and they're supposed to have our best interests. But obviously there's, another crisis in play right now, which is mental health and stuff, and it's affecting younger people, because people my age, they're socializing. I know where they're at.
I mean, I'm honestly not concerned about people following those sorts of things, because that's not what this whole thing's about. I mean, I do think that our proximity to Silicon Valley and the desire to destroy public education simultaneously is what this whole thing does. This is basically creating a situation where parents must choose different options for their kid if they're going to look after their kid. And now we have essentially we have created a situation where we're provoking parents into creating choice for themselves, choices other than public schools. And the backdrop to this is also artificial intelligence, data mining, putting everything online. Which is happening at the college level. It's now going to drop to the high school level. It will eventually get to the elementary school level. So it's cradle to grave data collection on all of us. So those are the things that are in play here. It has nothing to do with safety and people in groups. People are going to need to get in groups, as people saw around George Floyd.
Yeah.
All right. Frustrations boil over. Here they go. Last month, in the wake of months of protests for racial equity across the country, San Francisco's district administrators recommended a significant move. They told the principals of roughly one-third of the district's 125 public schools that their communities should start brainstorming new names for their schools, because the current names had historical associations with slavery, genocide, colonization, or other injustices. The list included schools named for George Washington and Thomas Jefferson as enslavers, Abraham Lincoln for his treatment of Native Americans, and even the state's senior U.S. Senator, Dianne Feinstein, over reports that as mayor in 1984, she replaced a vandalized Confederate flag outside City Hall. The news prompted a scathing statement from Mayor London Breed, who called it offensive to parents and to students, for the district to be focusing on renaming schools when it had no definitive plan for reopening them. Quote, "I had it, honestly," said Breed in an interview with our colleague Kate Taylor on October 22nd. Quote, "From my perspective, they weren't providing clarity about one of the most important things to kids and families in this city." San Francisco is 48% white, but as of 2019, the city's public schools were 15% white. 40% of students were Asian, 27% Latino, and 7% Black. Quote, the achievement gap is growing and there are kids who live in poverty who are falling behind, Breed said. Oh dear God, where to begin? There's so much in this section to respond to. I'm gonna start with the end part first because I agree with only one thing that she's saying, which is that schools need a plan for reopening. I don't think that she, I mean, come on, she's the mayor of the city. So this is political theater. This is her putting herself forward as a champion for the students of San Francisco, for the Black and Brown students of San Francisco. She has many other options she could do other than make a press conference, send out a letter and put a thing in the paper to say that this is wrong. I just don't buy that for a second. The interesting thing here at the end, you know, to go back to what we were talking about with public and private schools opening, is our public schools, this has for as long, I mean, I've been teaching for 20 years in this city, and it has always been that the majority, in the time that I've been here, this was not true historically in San Francisco, but the majority of white students in San Francisco have not gone to public schools for many, many, many years. This is obviously just going to continue to get worse and worse right now, because like Andy was saying, people are, if they have the means, are making choices right now to move their students, their children out of public schools. And some that I know, to move them out of the city, to be able to go to other districts that are open or to go to schools in other cities that are open. So this is absolutely true that it's going to continue to exacerbate the so-called achievement gap. That's another story, but I just don't buy it for a second that this is what she's focusing on. And personally, I won't go into the whole naming thing because I want to hear what other people think, but I believe in the capacity of people to do both of these things at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting, I mean, I definitely agree that Mayor Breed is basically saying one thing and doing another. But I as a school at Mission High School, which is one of the schools that's names on the block, I'm really in disagreement. Like, I just think this idea of changing names, of taking down statues, all this stuff, like that they're renaming this notion of representation as a way of saying this is how we're undoing racism by essentially saying, well, we're the Mission School or Lincoln School or Washington School, we're going to rename it and now it's going to be better. Now we don't have it. But to me, how is that pop? You can't do that and at the same time do distance learning, which is deeply racist, deeply divisive, deeply creating even a greater divide. And this whole data mining thing and this whole world that's essentially collapsing the economy, and the people on the bottom are getting farther down the bottom. And the people, if you're Black, your things are going to get worse for you, and Latino and immigrants. It's just it's really literally lipstick on a pig. And so to me, the notion of at the very time when we're not at our school to then talk about renaming our school and to then have, you can't really play a role in that. That to me is even more destructive to the notion that we actually live in a community or work in a community that we're together and be a part of. Like if you came to us at Mission and said, hey, look, we want to talk to you about renaming your school or Lincoln or Washington while we're there, then let's have that discussion. But I can guarantee you, I've talked to alumni of our school, and they're like, what are they talking about? If you want to change San Francisco, change that name. Where did that name come from? That's got to go. If you got to get rid of Mission, you got to get rid of San Francisco then. So, but I'm not even in for that whole thing of representation and the facade of dealing with racism it's like this election. It's like Biden. It's like Kamala Harris. So I actually agree with London Breed's words. I just know that she doesn't believe them. So, I am not in favor of this change in terms of the way they're doing it, because again, it's more stuff happening to us and more stuff being done to us while we're not in a place to actually collect and discuss and say, well, what do we think? And that should be happening with parents and students and former students, and people should be made aware about that, because they have a stake in their school, and you know, and they have a stake in what in the school they play sports at or did community stuff at, whatever. And you just, I don't think you just say, oh, we're renaming you because we think it's part of a legacy of racism and named after that. And it's like, well, let's deal with the legacy of racism by dealing with racism, not by putting changes of names.
Yeah, I just think optics, you know, is PR. And again, just trying to sweep the dirt under the rug, just kind of with Biden, you know, a lot of people saying that, you know, Trump, this horrible person is gone. But to bring it back to this is again, through the community work that I do, I see firsthand the disruptive, destructive material consequences of distance learning. There's so many single mothers, you know, working class mothers that have to choose between going to work or staying home. I see people that alternate, mothers that go to work, you know, and others, you know, stay at home. There are kids in situations that are, you know, very difficult, obviously. And again, the city officials, London Breed, know that this is happening. And again, when they talk about changing names or whatever, that it is pure symbolic posturing. And, you know, when the material reality of people is worse due to distance learning, especially when we know there are other options, you know, so it is atrocious and disgusting that they actually know this is happening and still, you know, dragging their feet, delaying the, you know, making this, you know, an actual thing, you know, reopening schools so people can actually work and function, you know, the poorest families in this city.
Well, if they're pathetic contribution to this idea this year that this year our school district is focused on anti-racist schools, anti-racist teaching, anti-racist whatever, and that everything we do is organized around that lens. I mean, it's whatever, name them all, PS 1 through 125, like I don't care. But what I was going to mention is that, you know, when y'all did the episode about taking down the mural at Lincoln, right? You know, I think about the difference in that being that actually came out of families and students at the school, right? Driving and pushing this. And, you know, they're, of course, I don't disagree that this is about them doing this thing over here that's theater and it's their way of saying, look, we're going to be an anti-racist school district. I don't know when this thing was planned, but it sure is disgusting that here we find ourselves in this crisis distance learning that is exacerbating and creating new opportunities for racism to infiltrate and destroy like every little piece of a child's education. And that's what they're going to do is, you know, contribute to it by changing school names. I don't disagree in the pointlessness of their what they're engaging in, but I do think it's kind of a I don't know if it's a straw man or what you kind of that kind of argument, but for her to even hold that up is really what the debate is about, is between either doing this or doing this. It's not, because they're both really of a piece,
right? And what do parents want? The president of the Board of Education suggested that parents of color whose families have been hardest hit by the pandemic in both the Bay Area and across the country were least eager to send students back to school. And it's true that child care centers for low-income families are operating below capacity. I would imagine that families are choosing not to go because they're afraid, said the board president, Mark Sanchez. He has argued that that calls for reopening are largely coming from a small group of well-off parents. Too simplistic, says Dayanira Calorrano, a community health worker who has an 11-year-old son in public school. Her neighbors in the Mission District, a historically Latino neighborhood, are afraid of catching the virus. But many parents still want their children back in classrooms, she said. Some mothers worry that their children are not making academic progress and are struggling with behavioral problems. Others have decided to go back to work to be able to help their children with distance learning. We are suffering an educational crisis, Calorrano said. I'll start just by saying that I agree that I have been speaking with friends and community members in my neighborhood, as well as folks that I know in the Mission District from my connection to Cesar Chavez Elementary School, Leonard R. Flynn and Bryant Elementary School. And there is a strong sentiment for families to go back to school. So I don't know where they're getting. Mark Sanchez is saying that it's coming from logic coming from a small group of well-off parents, because I have not seen a survey or statistics, so I'm just basing it off my anecdotal experience from being involved in my community. There is a growing majority in my community that would like to have their families back in school. They cannot function. Families are off to work thinking about their kids at home, the little ones being taken care of by siblings. I know at least three families who leave their older children with the smaller children, and that's not safe. I mean, there might be some, I was one of those older children that definitely was responsible, but it's an expectation that I think is not healthy to place onto kids, especially if they're going through their own, you know, mental health issues, if that older kid is going through mental health issues because of the confinement. And so what do people do? They connect with other family members, maybe, if they have that community, if they have, if they're not stopped by their own inhibitions, right, from going and asking for help, because people sometimes don't want to do that, or they might not even trust, even if they do receive that help. So the struggle is real, for sure. And the access to Zoom and virtual classrooms, it's not the same. I've been checking in with other people and their kids are so behind, just behind. And I'm not even comparing it to my nephew, who I know I give a lot of attention to, and my brother does as well. And we have a very strong nuclear family for him. I'm comparing it to other kids that I'm sort of assessing, you know, just from my background in education, where they're at. And a lot of what's going on is just also stress from parents taking it out on their kids, you know, placing them in front of another screen after, you know, all day. And it's just these inequalities are just being exasperated. It's really sad, really.
I agree with you that there are sizable number of families that want to go back. And this language, I would imagine that families are choosing, okay, this is imagination, because there has been no survey. They haven't even asked. There has been no even attempt to figure out from our families if they want to go back, because they don't care about whether or not families want to go back. You know, he's imagining this. He's not in the schools. He's not looking at muted black boxes every day. He's not talking to families, and he's not listening to high school students who are supposed to be managing their course load while they do childcare for all of their siblings and cousins and help them with their schoolwork. That's not his reality. So he knows much less than we do on this, in this group right here, about what families want. I'm confident of that. This idea, again, it's just like this idea that you're gonna somehow divide the families and divide the staff from the families and families from each other by saying it's a small group of privileged families who have other options, who are making this public. Well, those may be the families who the Chronicle interviewed, but that does not mean that was representative of who actually wants to go back. The high school families that I work with, they are, their parents very much want them to be back seeing other young people and in contact with other young people. They are so isolated and so worn down by the things like you were talking about, the mental health, the growing mental health concerns that parents have for their children is what I hear about every single time I talk to parents of my students, is about their concerns about their child not sleeping, their child not being, you know, not showing, demonstrating the same mood that they used to, and not being able to participate in life in the way that they did before. Almost to a person. That's what every conversation is about now.
Well, I would say, I mean, I know you're right, AJ, that Mark Sanchez has no idea what he's talking about, but I do know that families are afraid, or I have heard that fear from families, white families, black families, Latino families. I have heard that. Like, I just think a lot that is what this last year has been about. This last year has been about creating an environment of fear. And again, it's not unrelated to the changing goalposts. There's reason for belief. Parents should not be afraid about having their kids go to school based on all this evidence, but they're not hearing that. There's reason to believe that the fatality rate among young people based on actual evidence is so low, and the transmission rate is not as high as people are talking about, that there's reasons not to be so fearful that we have to just dismantle an entire system and make it so that your child has to have an experience of education only individualized through a box where, like you said, I hear children crying, I hear the mom trying to sweep and clean, or there's just so much going on in the background for a lot of these students, not all of them, but for a lot of them. And it's just not a good way to learn. And even if it's quiet, even if you have a quiet room, to log on from one class on first period and then go to another box in second period, then go to another box in third period and then have lunch or what have you, and then go to another box at fourth period, that is not a way to be doing school. That is the way it's moving in college. And I see that's how they're trying to move education into this more online, digitized, ultimately artificially intelligence done, black mirror nightmare. But it is not something we should be going to actively. And this is the thing that people have to be able, be more aware of. So I do think that fear is out there. It's just it's a cultivated fear. And it's really unfortunate. But I also know that parents are prepared to balance that fear with the fear of what's happening to the kid right now. And they need to be engaged in that discussion. And as you can see, the very top of this article is like saying, it looks like the whole calendar year is going to be, out of distance learning for high schools. Well, who decided that? What parents were consulted about that? They went on this whole tour during the summer to supposedly ask for parents. Now is the time to really engage people and be like, okay, what did you think of this of these last few months? And what do you want to do in January? That ain't going to happen because, again, they don't want to know because they want to make the decisions for us.
Yeah, there is no other message. There's nothing else. So you have, what I hear sometimes is that this desire for families to see their students be able to re-engage with their peers and with learning in a social way, and almost feeling like, guilty, like that's something that you shouldn't be able to want right now, because there just isn't anything else. There has been no survey. There's been no information. We don't share anything out because we don't have any plans to share. They don't hear anything. Families too are asking me, like you were talking about earlier, Andy, of, is it going to be December? Is it going to be January? Is my senior going to have a prom? Is there going to be a graduation? Like all of these things that, I feel like I fairly confidently can say right now, absolutely not. None of that stuff's happening, but there has been no communication, and we're continuing to do these family wellness checks, four times a year. We get to call all of them and ask how they're doing and share websites with them to try to address all of their needs. We're supposed to start doing that right now. We're supposed to be calling families for the next month and asking every single one of them how they're doing, asking them, I guess depending on the size of your school and the relationship you have with your families. I work at a very small school, so I can imagine having these conversations. I can't imagine having, 120 kids on my counseling load or something and having to call them all and ask them like out of the blue if they have enough to eat or if they're worried about their child's mental health when you have no relationship with people. It's like kind of insulting way to go about acting like you care about the families. But this is what the district has put into place to, again, make it look like they're caring about inequality that this situation is creating. Meanwhile, on the other side, they're moving full steam ahead with a nonstop roster of meetings for teachers and professional developments about how to use these technological tools better, starting to, like, I feel like we're starting to be funneled in certain directions of, like, certain ones they want us to use. So all of our data and feedback will go into those particular channels. And, you know, starting to treat this like this is the new normal way. Conversations about, like, what tools we'll want to be able to hold on if we have onto and continue to use if we ever go back to school. Like, what things are we learning now that are look like they're going to be great practices? All this talk about that I'm hearing at the high school level about personalized learning and individual paths to learning sort of set students up to be ready to continue to do school in a model that's not about collaborating and working with peers, but about having your one computer screen that you feed data into all day and takes you down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, I mean, look, when I put this forward, I know it's not going to be put forward because I know this whole thing is a setup to do exactly what you're saying, AJ. But imagine if they asked parents, teachers, and students, who's ready to go back? And those of us who are ready to go back, and those students who are ready to go back, we could go do that. We can start opening that place up. Like a mat, like we could have that sort of experience. Now, that doesn't change capitalism, it doesn't get rid of, but at least, at the very least, you're talking about a situation where we're matching up people who are ready with other people who are ready. And I feel like that's completely doable. And I understand that you have to open a facility up, but now we're talking about maybe actually keeping kids in what we were supposedly wanting to keep in public education instead of driving them either into pods this year or next year, or driving them into the electronic superhighway, which is coming to get those kids in the pods later. But, you know, for now, that's that would be the humane alternative if you were thinking about how to keep your kid in a situation that wasn't going to mess them up. So it's just like these things could be done and could be discussed and could be started, but we're not even talking about that. It's either you either all go this way. Well, we're all going one way, and coming back into the classroom and into our schools is not an option.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic that at least from, you know, when I was in school, there's always been debates of, you know, school class sizes. And, you know, if there was considering the information of the pandemic, if there was an opportunity to do smaller class sizes, it would be now, you know, and you know, like you said, obviously there is a more vulnerable population of students that maybe they do need to, you know, but yeah, why not? I'm just thinking out loud here, but.
All right. The power of teacher unions. Although children are at a lower risk if they are infected, teachers tend to be older and at higher risk. Schools other than an earlier outbreak in Israel do not seem to be stoking community transmission. That was parenthetically. In San Francisco, the teachers union has said conditions are not yet safe for classroom instruction. Across the bay in Oakland, the unions have said that their members do not want to return until there is essentially no local transmission. One hurdle is setting up a program of surveillance testing for school staff. State guidelines suggest testing all teachers every 2 months. Sanchez, the San Francisco school official, wants teachers tested every week. That's what private schools are doing, Sanchez said. Why aren't our teachers worth that?
Is that true? Or is the teachers union saying that? That, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that has definitely been the message from our teachers union. It's the national union, the statewide union, teachers union. And I do know that there's many teachers who I hear say that, like, we don't want to return until it's like completely safe. I personally feel like that position has been a position of abandoning our parents to their situation and has essentially played into the state's attempt and Silicon Valley's attempt to lock us into the situation that's going to destroy our schools. So I think we've fallen sucker for the trap. And in fact, I feel like we're actually breaking solidarity with our parents by saying, you keep your kid in your place. I don't want to be unsafe. You keep your kid in your place and you keep them at home. You have to work. You have to figure that out. I feel like there would be a lot more solidarity if we just said, look, how do we do this together so that you can work and we can, you know, we can work and we can actually do our jobs of that we are a daycare center for those parents who need that. And we are a place for their kids to socialize, and we provide that mechanism, and we provide the opportunity for the kid to be around an adult in a safer environment than where they normally were. And that's certainly true at the most at risk for the most at risk students. So we just abandon them, like as far as I'm concerned. And I know that there's going to be some teachers who are going to not like me when I say this, but frankly, I think teachers like this because it's easier. You don't have to deal with the drama. Like, I don't feel it's easier because it starts to make my head crazy, but do I go through the madness of a school day with classroom issues and things like that? No, I don't. Like, I can just kind of like walk out of bed and get ready for class and da 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 da. I don't have to do my commute. And I honestly think teachers at some level are like, well, this has kind of gotten rid of some of my problems, because some of the problems are not coming to class. And if they do come to class, there's limited ways for them to create some of the creative drama that they could create in my classroom, which is part of kids growing up, is being able to create that creative drama. And we have eliminated all that. And so I think, unfortunately, teachers think this is easier, but don't understand that we are destroying our profession. We are destroying the notion of public education. We are destroying these communities. And honestly, we are getting rid of our power, because the only way for me to go on strike is what? To do this, like, you know, log off, right? That like, that's a strike right there, right? And that's not doing anything. You can't go on strike. A strike is about being located in a city with other workers, and you organize from that place and you try to spread the strike, and that has been completely dismantled. I still think there are potential for work actions like that, but our ability to actually make capitalism nervous has been extremely diminished by being separated from our school. And I know teachers might not even think of that because they haven't gone on strike in 40 years, but if we ever are going to need to have power, we've eliminated that ability to have power by agreeing to this method of doing this. And so, ironically, teacher unions who think they're exercising their power by saying keep us safe have diminished our power. They've diminished the solidarity between us and our families, and they've diminished our connection with each other, and they're basically destroying our profession and turning us into gig workers.
It almost seems too that, like you said, this marks the beginning of the end for the profession, because you know you could be replaced by one teacher teaching a bunch of people soon enough, or artificial intelligence, you know, coming more into the post-education system.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. Nobody is looking at the fact that this is the beginning of the end, that it is. It's already happening. There are already a teacher I know at a middle school told me that her principal had started surveying all the teachers about which paraprofessionals were working and which ones were not. Like getting them to snitch on their workers about who was actually worth continuing to have at their school and who wasn't, right? They're already looking to try to figure out where to cut right now. And it's going to be the teachers, the power of the teachers union is the power of the bureaucracy, of the leadership, of the like layer at the top that has spent years just negotiating with other layers of power in our city. And they are, that power is being consolidated for them even more, because not only are we like not at our school sites and not able to actually talk about organizing and striking, we are not putting pressure on our union. Our union's not leading us to question what's happening. We are not demanding anything of them. We are just simply sitting back and allowing them to continue to tail the fear, all of the worries that are being put forward about why we can't possibly talk about going back. We were surveyed. It was 83% of our union members who responded to the survey, 83% of them said that they are not ready to go back. So there's a overwhelming majority of people who are saying that there's no way that they're ready to go back right now. And I totally agree that it is like, it is abandoning our families and abandoning, you know, really any future for there to be anything like schools, period, schools. You know, there's certain functions that schools perform that capitalism is figuring out how to have those functions performed in other ways. The childcare function and the funneling of all this data into the pockets of Silicon Valley, those two things can be separated. You know, they don't have to happen together. They don't have to happen in a building. And I think that's what's being figured out right now. And this is a total distraction, this idea that somehow it is the teachers, you know, the power of the teachers union is what is the crux here. Teachers union are completely going, the leadership's going along with it 100%, just following along with this story. But, you know, this is an old trope to just make it about, you know, the union is standing in the way of whatever it is that families want. But in this case, we have divided ourselves from families and are putting ourselves in a position to, you know, really be representing a different set of interests from our families when they should be united.
I'm glad you said it first, Dundee, when you said about it being easier. There are challenges with this. But I was in conversation with a group of former colleagues, and they were talking about how much time they have on their hands now. And I'm not saying that's true for everyone. I'm speaking specifically about my former colleagues. Not everyone has, right? But also talking about not having the stress they had. And I don't think they should be stressed, right? But it is easier. I don't know how to frame it. They were saying how they could almost see themselves doing this for a longer time. Mm-hmm. And I felt there was a certain comfort in it, not in, like a form of resignation, more of a comfort. Now, this isn't to represent all of teachers. I'm just speaking about some, and with some of my former colleagues. But there is a struggle. It's like I used to say to some colleagues, when you work in a public school, it's like working in a hospital. Sometimes you have to deal with crises. You have to deal with kids' behavior. You have to deal with it all. That's why you can't just expect to go to school and just to expect us to teach your lesson. Part of it is being, you know, the cap of being a counselor. Part of it is being the sort of parental figure that sometimes they look up to. They don't have that. Or part of it is being that encourager, your cheerleader, right? And other times you are being a little bit strict with them when you have to be. And other times, you know, you do have a chance to, or a moment of like, whoa, this was an incredible teaching day, right? But that's part of being in, or working with kids. And so I just hope that they don't get into the comfort of it because it's easy for them, but they really see how this is affecting them personally, because yes, it is going to affect them in the long run if they lose their job, but also our kids, right? I mean, I hope that they look out for our kids, our communities, our families. I think that most of people go into this profession because they want to do some social change in some way, shape, form or another. And I hope people don't lose sight of that. I don't know if that's the majority or minority. I'm not saying that's what majority of teachers do or feel. I'm just saying I hope whoever's feeling that they connect back to the reason why they were a teacher or why they got into this field of education, right?
I want to respond to that, both what you said, Eduardo, and Andy, because I think I just want to emphasize something a little bit different. It's not that I don't think that that experience exists that you're both describing, but I think it's more that this way of doing school has fragmented our experience of what it means to be teachers, because there are many teachers who I also know who are having a much harder time now because they are also managing their own children's schooling, because it is just completely incompatible for them to be working at home in a way that's unisolated and not social and are really, really suffering. Like, so I think that the experience is a lot depends on what's happening inside that house for the teacher and what's going on in the rest of their life and who else they're having to take care of. But when we all used to go to the building together and work together during the day, we had a much more of a shared experience of what a school day was like and what it was like to do our job. I mean, we're all doing the same like this now, but the experience of who you're interacting with and what else is going on around you has completely changed. And so we don't have the same common day-to-day experiences, and it looks really different, I think.
I appreciate your insertion, AJ. It's very important. I should say I was speaking to a bunch of single young teachers.
And I should say I'm currently a single, but not young teacher. But I won't be single too long.
And again, it's not a representation. These are a group of friends. But yes, and we should acknowledge that. I'm glad you spoke up and you said that, AJ.
Yeah.
There are other families. When I think of it, I can count other families that I haven't checked in with, but they have kids at home. I don't know how they can juggle all that. Yeah.
I'm curious, do you see an irony that maybe some teachers or many teachers have become the students that, you know, were disengaged, you know, in just going through the motion because, you know, you have to kind of go through it. And, you know, how do you reach those teachers? And I'm guessing that this is what, you know, you're doing this show today, but I mean, I guess we're still in the middle of it trying to figure it out, but, you know, any thoughts on how do you reach these people? You know, these teachers that are just going through the motions and,
I'm not sure I would say going through the motions, but who are kind of go along with what is happening and kind of accepting that this is kind of a new normal. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it is just an act of like surrender almost, you know, like this is what it is, you know, and yeah. I just have to get through it. And that's what I mean by going through the motions.
Yeah, okay. AJ, do you have a thought on that one?
Well, I'll start by saying I totally understand that. I mean, there was a certain point at, I don't know, early in this year where I realized for my own mental health, I couldn't spend every single faculty meeting, every single gathering with teachers, like railing against distance learning for my own sanity and continued ability to function. I think I would say for me right now, I know that number is teeny, teeny, tiny of people who are saying, this is just wrong and this needs to stop. And I'm interested in finding out if there's more, you know, I don't think that there's a lot. And I don't think that, looking to like have the power to, you know, shift the whole dynamic around this conversation, because it's so much bigger than education, you know, but for me, it's just a question of finding who those people are right now at my school site and us kind of just holding each other together, because it is so, so demoralizing. And I have no idea what, you know, I can't even look like to next year or down the road or what it will mean as this sort of develops in whatever way it's going to develop. I'm confident that this is, you know, not the end of technology and online learning in our schools. What it's going to look like next year, I have no idea. But it is a lot about like just helping each other find ways to stay afloat right now, and also not being afraid to say that I see something wrong, because that is the only way that I'm going to find anybody else who does, right?
Yeah. I would say my first answer is I'm not sure how to do it. Second answer would be we are doing this episode. So obviously I'm like, okay, I know where AJ's at. I know where I'm at. I know that we were going to poke some holes into this notion of just going of a whole year of distance learning. But my most sincere answer is I'm not entirely sure how this is going to happen, because what I fear is what AJ was talking about. There's going to be a whole panel of teachers who are going to learn these technology skills and are going to be able to sell them to the district or to their employer and say, hey, I can teach 30 kids, I can teach 40 kids, I can teach 60 kids. And that's how this stuff's going to go. And it's going to, I mean, it's only later down the road that they're going to get replaced. But, you know, even in China, as they talk about the developing of AI, they're talking about one center that has 120,000 employees. And in 5 years, they expect to have 80,000 employees. It wasn't in education, it was another area. But this is how this works. AI is about getting rid of us and replacing us with computers and for efficiency, for profits. So that's what's happening in China. That's the road the US must go on if they're going to compete with China. And so that's the future. But how do we find those people? AJ and I have talked about something today that I think we have some ideas about, but I'm not sure.
Mental health considerations. In Oakland, UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital, Oakland, has seen an increase in mental health challenges for children. Out of all children aged 10 to 18 treated at the hospital's emergency department, 16% screened positive for suicidal thoughts in September, an increase from 6% in March. According to Jacqueline Group Phelan, the chief pediatric emergency medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Quote, we really absolutely have to consider that the cure might be worse than the disease, end quote, Group Phelan said.
I was just going to say that it's hard to say this without people associating you to Trump, because he says the cure cannot be worse than the disease, I think he said. I forget what it's similar, the phrase is. And when I have said this, I said, oh, you just buy into the Trump. And I remember someone said that to me. I thought, what? No. This is something that even the Academy of Pediatrics had come out to say. And I invite people to look at our episodes with Tracy Burt and Stephen Rico, who they are professionals within the child and adolescent development, where they... as college instructors, they have looked into this, the increase of mental health issues. That's the word. I don't know why issues. It's not a big word. Issues. Mental health issues have arisen because of the confinement. You just separate people from the communities. You isolate them, or you do more of what you did already when school was in session, which was video games for adolescents. Some of them, not all, but. And then you have a confinement, you increase the number of hours that you're on that television or computer screen. I could just see how this is one of the things that most people are not having at their forefront. This is what's happening. This is not something we should ignore. And unfortunately, as these numbers are showing, suicidal thoughts, kids are being screened. 10 to 18, children's age 10 to 18 treated at hospital emergency. I mean, this is serious stuff that we need to look into. And it's damaging kids because they're not in schools where they should be with their social peers, with their peers.
I would just say this is the, all of the parts about what's happening to education and what it means to work in schools and teaching, that part, it all makes me very angry, but this part is the part that's the realest for me every day when I actually manage to connect with students. And the students at the school where I work, they're at that school. It's one of the alternative high schools in the city. So they're at that school because they have already had experiences that were extremely negative and or unsuccessful in a comprehensive high school, and they choose to come here. We have lots and lots of students who already, you know, are struggling with anxiety, with mental health, with depression, with all kinds of things that we, when we have a school building, have people there all day long set up to make personal contact with them and to try the best we can to support them through that. And that is the amount of withdrawal, just isolation that we are seeing right now is very, very upsetting. Students who, you know, disappear from contact, we don't know where they are for a couple weeks that we were already very worried about. Students withdrawing into, you know, physically withdrawing into their rooms, withdrawing into their beds, withdrawing from, you know, students who show up who are logged into Zoom but are not there, they do not respond verbally, or it's like so disconnected that you can, you know, be talking to them, saying their name, speaking to them, and it's so isolating. I'm not talking about people who are messing around because they're over playing video games or like eating crackers during their class or whatever. I'm talking about people who this experience of having school like this is so alienating that you can be sitting there muted with your camera off and I can be talking directly to you. And it's as if we're, you know, this isn't a real interaction. So I don't, you know, there's no need for me to respond. I can't respond. It's just really serious. I've had a suicide of a student every year for the last 3 years, and that was before this. You know, this part is terrifying to me.
I mean, yeah, I'm just wondering. You know, this is, I guess we're sort of in the middle of the storm. We don't know the aftermath. You know, that if the long term consequences that this is going to have in the, because, you know, like I was obviously young once, but I was deeply depressed, you know, in college for those same reasons. You know, I felt isolated. I felt disconnected. It was the darkest time in my life. And, you know, and I can relate to empathize with some of these kids. And there were a lot of kids struggling before this. You know, it just wasn't a safe world for them. You know, the overwhelming, the, you know, overstimulation, the expectations, and now, you know, you take away the social aspect that was somewhat a refuge, you know, or the, like a raft, and yeah, it's concerning, you know, and this is going to manifest in many ways in the long run, and not just that, but we're ushering in a new era. It's not that an acceleration, right, of a process. In the name of safety, you know, we went from saying screens were unsafe and unhealthy to we're doing this for safety and for your own good. And the sad part is that people that should be, at least in my mind, more equipped to challenge that notion, teachers, are going along with it, you know. And so it's sad, it's concerning, and you know, even evidence doesn't seem to play a role here, because again, we began this conversation with like what other countries are doing, other places, you know, what's happening in New York, what even I remember when Georgia reopened, right? Or like the South, and there was you know, a lot of coverage and kind of shaming them for doing it. And, you know, and by and large, not much happened, you know? And so there is plenty of evidence now that, you know, it's safer. You know, there are ways to make it happen, but at least in this city, you know, yeah, it makes me angry, and you know, I feel disgusted, and I'm not surprised because we're at the epicenter of tech capitalism.
Yeah, the only thing I really agree, and I'm just thinking about my own experience. I mean, I'm 54. I was been alive 53 years of what we would somewhat describe as normal human interaction. And it hasn't taken that many months for me to kind of feel strange outside, be awkward, be more awkward with interacting with individuals, crossing streets because masks and maybe we shouldn't be, you know, and just being just more unfriendly. And this is happening to these young people at a very young age to have a very alienating experience with the world. And what a difference it would make for them to have one place they could come to where they could be reminded of what it's like to be around other people, and that's being taken away from them, let alone the idea of playing on a soccer team or, you know, playing tennis or, you know, any sort of these things, which we have always talked about as being the one thing that often helped the student get interested in their future when they didn't think they had a future. So it's dreadful. So they are learning. I mean, these kids are learning, but they're learning to not trust each other, to be alone, to be isolated. That's what they're learning. And it's absolutely the wrong lesson. And we teachers are very much responsible for this happening.
We can either include this or not include this, but I just want to share a personal anecdote where it's, most of you know, I mentored then informally fostered a former student of mine, and he is right now at home, and my struggle is trying to get him out of the house or do something. And he's living with his dad, and he's cooped up in, like, I call his man cave. It's just a small room, and just trying to get him to do something is just challenging already when before the pandemic. And then now with it, he's just resigned himself to no job, nothing, no socialization. He doesn't go out. And it's so tough just being there trying to control him, tell him to come out. Then he tries to scare me with, I have COVID-19, don't come over, which is not true. So it's just, I don't know, it's tough. And he's part of that age where most of his generation dates now online. Don't find people. How do you, you know, connect with people? And this has just exasperated that. So anyhow, it's hit home. Not like I myself feel that way, as I had a very busy life, but I imagine it being in the way that I have to look over my brother, my younger one.
Weighing the risks. Experts have expressed concern that if San Francisco and other Bay Area districts wait much longer to open schools, infections will rise significantly again, making it more difficult to reassure people that schools are safe. Matt Aldrich, the executive medical director of critical care at UCSF and a father of two children in the district, said he was disappointed that there had been little discussion among members of the Board of Education about the largely reassuring evidence so far from school reopenings across the country and abroad. If we say that the only way that we can return to school is to have some plan that seemingly guarantees that there will be zero cases at all, that just strikes me as setting us up to never return this year, he said. I wish this were at the beginning. Again, it's like burying this information that there are actually successful models out there till the end of the article.
But I'd also say that really is what's happening, is brick and mortar schools are being taken down. Public education, as we've previously knew it under capitalism, is going to be eradicated as this kind of communal experience. Just like more of us will become gig workers, we are going to become gig learners. And you're going to have to learn on a screen as you go from screen to screen to screen, as you assemble different skills online through a combination of remote teacher and machine that's teaching you this kind of stuff. That is where this is all headed. And largely in a data collection competition between US and China to see who can collect the most data on its own citizens, on its own on consumers abroad, in an attempt to develop AI. I mean, that really is the simplest way for me to put it, and to dominate markets and to dominate military and all that kind of stuff. So we're in this machine, and we're seeing the destruction of something that was. The only thing I would say is what's been apparent for me is that what was also deeply flawed, but I can see that it can get worse. And that's why this whole system has to go and it has to be changed. But I actually think if we carry on this way, I think we're actually going to even lose the ability to put up that fight. And that does worry me. So I think his last line about what does he say? It just strikes me as we're setting up to never return this, not just this never return this year, we're being set up to never return of a sort. That might be hybrid schools, maybe next year, next school year. But by and large, the plan is to get rid of brick and mortar schools and to get rid of human teachers. That's the long-term plan. And to put everyone into a data mining operation of some sort.
Yeah, I do think it's, you know, it's it's an end of the idea of education happening, public education happening since its institution in this country, the way they've sort of set up with this unchanging model of everybody kind of getting these basics of reading, writing, some sort of mathematics, a little bit of history to make you a good citizen and an excellent voter. And then, you know, some of you will get funneled off into liberal arts colleges, and based on the needs of capital, you can get sort of put into these different areas. Do we need more engineers? Do we need more people designing machines to build cars? Now it's like, you know, that can sort of be recreation for the most privileged, and the rest is just turning into fodder or the fuel that these systems, these information systems, are going to run off of. So I don't think that there, I mean, I just think that those things are so linked that there's no way that we really, that I see, at least in my conversations with the folks that I've, you know, have been my little lifeboat at school this year so far, there's no way to talk about one without the other. Just, you know, sort of the mental health of our students, or how this isn't, you know, this isn't the kind of education that any of us wanted to be involved in, you know, that our students and families are suffering. That whole conversation is completely intertwined with sort of the direction that this is all going. And San Francisco is, you know, it takes me back to that comment that you made earlier about it being the safest, city. You know, it's also, it's like, these things are not separate. We're not, the fact that we are the safest city is inextricably tied to the fact that we are this close to Silicon Valley, and that we are going to be, whatever that word is that I can't think of, we're going to be the bullseye. I'll put it on a bullseye. We're going to be the bullseye for the target for developing this new way of schooling, I think.
I guess I'll just say that from the article, I couldn't agree more with the very last statement that was said there. And that is that when would be the right time to open public schools then? Because if it's going to be when it's completely safe, then that means never. It's like what we said in my learning pod. We had a discussion amongst us, and someone said, we were talking about what we should or cannot do, or what maybe how we can be preventative in our personal lives, because we come together and we have our personal lives and we do other things. And one member of our group said, we have to try to limit so many other things. And the other member said, wait, we just cannot, there's no way we can prevent from getting COVID. There's just no way that this group isn't meant to completely stop, or just, it's just to be able to prevent, but there's no way we're never going to get it. We're doing our best to prevent. The measures are there, but it's only to lower the risk. That doesn't mean that there aren't risks. And so I guess I'm relating it with this, that people say until it's completely safe to go back to school, there are going to be risks. I mean, even when there was before this whole confinement, there were risks already. There are all kinds of risks, you know, mass shootings, you know, risks of going to school and being getting sick from other sicknesses as well. I mean, like the flu, you do get sick. I would get sick all the time from the kids. Risks from angry parents. I remember back at school where they would threaten us. There's all kinds of risks. You're just lowering risks. Right? And so you have to go back, and there's just no safe return. There isn't. It's an illusion. There's no safe return. There are greater risks, I would actually argue, by not returning. Anyhow, someone else can go.
I mean, things are bad, you know, and like, I guess this is the somewhat, that's the somewhat optimistic part is that we have no other choice but to fight back and find a way, you know, in, I don't know, you know, like I can either just sit down and like be completely hopeless and like not expect better, you know, and I don't know, I guess what I'm saying is that, yeah, just gotta find a way to push back and organize and keep talking about this. Maybe we'll find some other people that are as crazy, you know, concerned about this and willing to do something about it. You know, because for me, yeah, like nothing is disconnected, you know. This is not disconnected from the world politics. This is not disconnected from, you know, what's coming down the pipe, you know. And it's going to come after everyone, you know. It's going to catch up to everyone, you know. No one's safe in this idea that some people are, you know, even if you're rich and privileged, you know, like someone is going to come and want to get your, you know, come to your house with pitchforks, you know, because I will, you know, I'm not going to go hungry and just wait for someone to hand me something out, you know. So, you know, I don't know, just got to push and figure it out and just be aware of the fear mongering, obviously fear sells and yeah. I don't know, just push.
AJ, do you want to have any final thoughts since you're our guest here today? I think we'll probably wrap it up here.
I'm not optimistic, mm-hmm. but I'm very interested to find out where this all goes because, you know, getting rid of and demolishing the organized workforce that is teachers, public school teachers in this country, that is no small feat. Not that we've been, you know, certainly not in San Francisco striking and fighting back and whatever. Nonetheless, we've continued to be, and over the last few years, you know, some of the things that have happened continued to be one of the larger, more organized, more militant sections of an extremely disorganized and non-militant working class in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, got to take what you can get and work with that. So, you know, I think it is, I have no idea what that's going to look like here. You know, if they start to do massive layoffs over the next year, which I cannot see any other way around. Like, I just don't see how that will not happen. I just don't see how that's going to be. If I were a member of the ruling class in San Francisco, that's what I'd be going for. You know, seeing what I could do. That would be my next move, is to wipe out classified and see about places where we could consolidate and increase class sizes massively so that we could eliminate some folks. And I'll be interested to see what happens when it is no longer as hidden, what this means for the future of teaching as a job and the future of public schools as a place where, you know, for hundreds of years, people have had the expectation that that's where children will spend the first 13 years of their life, 13 years of schooling. I'm really appreciative to have this conversation. I'm glad that you are continuing to talk about it multiple times throughout the year, because it's not a cheery conversation. When I talk about it with my friends who aren't working in schools, it kind of gets to this point that I feel like we're sort of at in this episode where it's like, wow, it is really shitty. It's like, yes, there's no happy ending to this story right now. I don't have any good place to tell you it's going. There it is. but, you know, it's important for us to to be real about what's happening, and that things are, there isn't a plan for us to go back. Things are not getting better. There's not some secret plan for families to return to schools, and we need to keep exposing that, I think.
Thanks for doing this, AJ.
Thank you.
What do they say? It gets darkest before the dawn. But the problem is, maybe it's going to get darker. That would suck.
Well, we don't know what the darkest is yet.
How dark can it get?
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead, Rona.
All right. That does it for this week's episode. What's Left is a weekly political podcast slash channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes, wherever you found this episode, or on our blog at what-s-left.webnode.com. And you can find past episodes to this podcast slash channel there and connect with us. I remind folks that if you like anything that you have heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, subscribe, and turn on your notifications on any of our 6 platforms on Spotify, iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. If you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts Andy Luzon, Kenny Cepeda, and AJ Johnstone. Did I say it right?
You got it. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. See you next time. Ciao. I was going to say go vote for some reason. Sorry. See you next time. I always added something.
For sure.
See you next time. Ciao.